Welcome back to the Motherlode Show. I am Jackson Dunn here on 88.3 FM. Last week, I was talking a little bit about freedom, specifically in reference to the Hong Kong situation. This week, I'm going to go into a little bit of the historical failures that we've had in the United States in promoting freedom around the world and what we can do to fix that and make that something that is more important to us on a daily basis here in the country. We can't fix everything, but at least we can talk about it, and we're going to start talking about it right now on The Motherlode Show. A lot of people, especially in more recent days, have complained that the United States is too territorial and has been out there trying to build, as they call it, the American Empire. And while it's true, of course, that the United States came out of the empire, the British Empire, they were, of course, an offshoot of that. Their wars of conquest, if you will, were ideological rather than territorial. One of those cases might be somewhere like Cuba, which was allowed, not exactly, of course, peacefully, but allowed to break off from the United States. Places like Vietnam as well, where the United States probably could have come in, done a glass carpet type thing where they just bombed the entire country of Vietnam and got out of there, or tried to take over the country, but instead they tried to fight on the ground and tried to build an alliance based on the ideas of democracy with the people of Vietnam. Now, of course, this has failed spectacularly, and I think one of the reasons why I actually say that the United States was not a country that was an empire builder, but rather was an ideological fighter, was because of the places that the United States did not fight. The times that they didn't get into war when they really should have, even from a pragmatic outsider perspective. And I think some of those, of course, were blunders of the United States foreign policy, but even more so, some of those were blunders in crises of conscience, if you will, when the United States really just, because it didn't seem right at the time, decided not to get into a war that would have been not only just, but probably, looking back in the lens of history, and I know hindsight is, of course, 2020, but would have been a good war to get into and a good war to fight. And the United States, contrary to the accusations nowadays that it was an empire-building country, stayed away from wars that they should have gotten into and would have maybe better promoted freedom across the world. Now, of course, a modern case of this, which I talked about again last week, is the case in Hong Kong, where the United States is really not getting involved. Maybe in the future they will, and I obviously can't speak about that. But right now, they're not as involved as maybe they should be. The people of Hong Kong are in the fight for their lives, in the fight for democracy. And the United States is staying aloof. A little bit of the American exceptionalism. But more than that, America doesn't really want to get into the business of trying to build an empire, trying to carve territory out of other countries. This isn't something that the United States has done. And actually, our biggest rival for many, many years, Russia, they decided not to get into a war with Russia when they probably should have. For those of you who are, of course, old enough to remember the Cold War, and even some of those who are students, of history, you might say, but look, in the Cold War, the United States and Russia, it's a good thing they didn't get into a war. We wouldn't have wanted a nuclear war. We wouldn't have wanted that brought on people. But a lot of people don't realize that the reason that the United States had the rival in the first place, in the Cold War, was because of a crisis of conscience that happened many years before in the United States. And to study that, we have to go back to a little bit of turn of the century history. There was a candidate back during the 1900 to 1920 elections, actually. He didn't run in all of those years consecutively, but 1900, 1904, 1908, 1912, and then 1920 later on. There was a candidate who ran in the United States named Eugene Victor Debs, Eugene V. Debs, as he was known. And he was one of the first, and certainly the most influential, at one point garnering 6% of the vote, the most influential socialist candidate of that period. And during the turn of the century, after the 1860s, okay, when we had the Industrial Revolution, and when Karl Marx first put out his idea of communism, socialism and communism were the same thing, okay? So we had the ideas of socialism that were embraced by certain people, certain politicians within the United States, but there was no distinction in name between socialists and communists. Indeed, a communist was a specific type of socialist that was specifically a follower of the ideas of Karl Marx. But generally, the whole idea of from the rich to the poor, you know, from each according to his means, to each according to his need, was kind of the idea of all socialism. And Eugene V. Debs was certainly the first one who was a major candidate who ran as a socialist candidate, actually, and garnered a significant amount of the vote. He was also one of the few third-party candidates who garnered as much of the vote as he did, with 6% in 1912, as I said earlier on. Later on, he would go to prison for sedition against the United States. In 1918, he had a 10-year sentence in prison for speaking against World War I. It wasn't only that he spoke against it, but specifically that they thought he was leading a sedition. But with all of that said, Eugene Debs brought out a bombshell theory, a new theory that each person should be able to give, and we're all a big family, basically. That we shouldn't be supporting property, right? That each person shouldn't be having individual property, but rather that we should be sharing it between ourselves. That as socialists, we ought to do what's best for society, not what's best for the individual, like the ideas of freedom that the United States had originally been founded on would dictate. He wasn't the first person who was, of course, socialist in nature or had socialist ideas, but certainly the first one who was very open about it in politics and had a good following. People like Theodore Roosevelt, who considered themselves progressive, if you will, had some socialist ideas, but certainly nothing outside of the realm of what would have normally been an ordinary political thought in the United States. And why was this such a crisis of conscience, as I said earlier, right? Why just because some guy ran on a platform and he got a small but significant part of the vote? Why would this be such a crisis of conscience in the United States? And to answer that, we have to kind of look at the way the world was at that time and the way in which the world shaped up after the World Wars. Because before the World Wars, a lot of these ideas existed out there as political theories, the theories of socialism, the theory of communism, the theory of fascism. And when you talk about a theory in theoretical, purely theoretical terms, most of them sound honestly pretty good because you can spin your theory to be as good as you want. But the time during the World Wars, when new countries were being shaped, new empires were rising and old ones falling, was the perfect testing ground for a bunch of these theories. And before and after the World Wars, we got to see a snapshot, a picture of what these theories would really mean in real time and what they would mean, the moral implications of them as well. You see, during the same time, there was another party that was rising in Germany. And we, of course, know it nowadays as the infamous Nazi Party. But at the time, it was nothing more than the National Socialist Party. A party that wasn't really that controversial, any more so than one of our parties in the United States are today. Right? We don't have a functioning Nazi Party in the United States. And at the time of the early turn of the century, specifically right after World War II, the Nazi Party was nothing more than people who wanted to see the country gain some nationalist pride but follow socialist principles. The same was true with someone like Eugene Debs. Eugene Debs had a theory that the United States should follow these ideas of communism. And people were a lot more overt about communism because there wasn't the negative connotations about it like there are today. So he was pretty overt about the fact that he was supporting an idea that was, for all intents and purposes, communism. A lot of people don't also realize that at the same time, the 1920s, the Russian Bolshevik Revolution was taking place. Actually, my family came over during a little before this time, but around this time from Russia, Jewish family kicked out in the pogroms. But the same thing was kind of happening over in Russia. They were switching from their system of government under the Tsar, the imperial system of government, if you will, and going to the communist system of government. And during that time, the United States was actually sending over famine relief to Russia because their people, as socialism was just starting to be implemented, people realized that when there was no incentive anymore for people to work, right, you wouldn't get more stuff because you worked. Rather, it would be taken and given to the poorest. That was the way that socialism was intended to work. But people stopped working because there was no reason to. If you worked hard, you didn't get any more food. If you worked less, you got no less food. So what was the use? And nobody really kept on working and kept on doing the things that they needed to be doing. And for that reason, the USSR, as it later came to be known, was going through a time of famine. And the United States was actually bailing them out, was giving them a lot of stuff. And the reason that the United States didn't take a little more firm stance like they did in other conflicts, like they did in World War II, when they were finally faced with some of the consequences of these political theories that had come out of Europe at the time, was because the United States was going through its own same crisis of identity, if you will. The idea between what is more important, the society or the individual. People like Woodrow Wilson were leaning, if not very much, into socialism. And the reason why is because at the time it sounded like a dream. That everybody would be able to work and be able to work for as much as they needed, but wouldn't need to be rich. But instead all of that excess that would make people rich, make the capitalists rich. And at the time they were dealing with a lot of problems with monopolies taking over industries. But all of that money that monopolies and rich capitalists, if you were skimming off the top, would be going to the poor. And it sounded great. It sounded like a dream. And for this reason, the United States started to really warm up to this political theory that people should be able, or society, I should say, not people, but society in general should be able to take from the individual if the need arose for it from some other individual in society, so that everybody would get a kind of fair shake. And that kind of language has really existed even until today in the United States lexicon, in the way in which we approach politics. Entitlements are basically part of this. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was very into the ideas of socialism, and for this reason we have things like the Social Security entitlements, the things that we feel entitled to now, but really, you know, are something that came out of this socialist mentality of the 1920s to 1940s. Now, why is this a problem? Because I said it was a problem before, but of course some of the things we like having some of those social safety nets, if you will. But why was it such a problem, and why did it lead us to so many problems back then? And the reason is because we had forgotten a little bit about who we were supposed to be as a country. You see, when the founders of the United States first wrote the Constitution, one of the things that they were very adamant about is, as you well know, if you're even, you know, have a basic knowledge of history, was they were very into the people's rights, right? That is the reason there is a Bill of Rights. That is the reason that the whole Constitution begins with "we the people." And it was very focused on what people had the right to have and what the government did not have the right to do to people. One of the amendments in the Bill of Rights, Amendment 9, says that any right that is not specifically talked about in the Constitution, anything that the government is not specifically given the authorization to do, is reserved for the people. So basically, you're not allowed if you're the government. To take away the rights of people for any reason, and something also that isn't specifically a right but isn't given to the government to do, has to stay outside of the public sphere of law. So, of course, you can do things like make rules against murder, because, indeed, the whole Declaration of Independence was built on the basis of supporting life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, things that were specifically given to the government to protect. But at the same time, the government wouldn't be able to do things like get into your personal beliefs, wouldn't be able to get into your personal business. These things are specifically reserved to you. Or they can be, in some cases, given to the state. Not to the state in general, but to your individual state that you live in. The reason why is because at the time of the founding, the founders were going through a similar idea to socialism, but rather it came from the imperial government, from the king, King George of England. And that was that King George believed that for the good of society, people, especially the settlers who came over to colonize the United States, would have to follow his very strict rules of law and would have to follow his very strict stuff. And if they didn't, he would tax them punitively. They wouldn't get a say in their government. They wouldn't get a say in their laws. And a lot of their laws were either, one, ridiculous and on a whim, or secondly, really didn't apply to colonial settlers, might have applied in somewhere like London, where it's a city, very well developed, very large, but didn't work for somebody who was living in the middle of the woods trying to fight off hostiles and also trying to build themselves a life. And for this reason, the founders realized that the way that government works is government tries to consolidate power, right? It's in each person's nature to want to have control over their lives and over their situation. And the same is true for governments because they're made of people. That as soon as you give a power to the government, it will take more and more and more. It won't give up power unless you either violently or through legal means take it away from the government, right? The government doesn't purposely give up. And you can see this nowadays. Look at how many laws are on the books compared to 100 years ago. The simple fact is that it's much harder to destroy old laws. There are a bunch of laws on the books that are honestly very obsolete. But it's much harder to destroy laws than to make laws, because for every situation that seems bad, like for instance, recently around this area in the capital region of New York, we had a limousine crash, a huge limousine crash. You know what I'm talking about if you're from up here. And of course, the first thing that the legislature did is we need new limo laws. We need laws to control the limos and make sure that they're inspected and that their drivers have very good licensing. When the real problem was not the licensing, right? The limo was specifically breaking the law by being unlicensed. Two, the driver didn't hold the adequate license to drive the limousine. And thirdly, the inspection had been carried out so poorly that the brakes failed on the limousine. So the fact is that legal means weren't really helping. But it is the knee-jerk reaction of power to try to control every variable and control every situation. It doesn't even make you a bad person. But this is what power does. It makes you think that you have either the right or the ability to control situations which you do not have. And for this reason, to lead to tyranny. But fast forward to this idea of socialism. Because the United States had lived under this idea of individualism and we had been so free, we had also allowed, and for better or worse, some companies, such as monopolies, to take over large areas of the United States economy, and then to basically dictate prices and to gouge people on them. And it was hurting a lot of people, and it was understood that. Now, had, at the time, people waited, and also taken away barriers to entry for certain businesses so that businesses who had entrepreneurs and had less money would have a fair shot at starting their business, it's likely enough that the monopolies would have been broken. This is just the way of business. If you don't stay on top of things, if you don't use it, you lose it, right? And monopolies are no different. Unless a monopoly is very strong, and in some cases there are, but usually if they are strong enough to keep everybody out of business, they are also doing something illegal, which you can catch them on. But at the same time, there was a legitimate concern that some people and some businesses had too much power. And for this reason, socialism sounded like a dream, because it was basically saying, no, you take that power, you take that extra money from those rich people and give it to the poor people. And even today, when people talk about it, a lot of young people, especially people without a lot of money who have a lot of student debt and other things, say, wow, it sounds like a dream. Take that money away from the banks and give it to me to pay off my student loans. But the simple fact is that as soon as you give the government the power to arbitrate who has too much money and who has too little, a lot of rich people will go into government to protect their own assets. And because they're in government, they can make laws that give them loopholes to keep their money, but take it away from the middle class without power, the people who are hardest working for what they make and really don't try to play with the loopholes and play tricks, but rather just pay their way into the system, if you will. And so they take the money from those people, and that continues to happen today. A lot of people do that in politics and try to play to this type of voter, the voter who thinks that socialism sounds like a dream, but it actually is going to end up raising their taxes and other things. All of that aside, that's what was going on during the 1920s. And without the shocking realization of how bad communism was, without understanding, like we do today, how bad Stalin was, how many of his own citizens he killed. Chairman Mao in China, the fact that he killed double, basically, what Stalin and Hitler did together. And while it's true that the reason we talk about Hitler as being the most evil of the three is because his ideology was so barefaced, and his ideology was so wrong in the way in which he brought it out, right? That it was specifically racially motivated. So it was against a type of people and a class of people who had no choice over why they were being killed. But because of his maniac desire to kill all Jews and kill all people who weren't Aryans, he decided to start his, of course, Holocaust. But the fact that we don't talk about Chairman Mao or Stalin in the same breath as Hitler is because the same ideas, the same things, the same ideology that was driving the two of them and that drove them to do what is the logical conclusion of socialism, which is that anybody who won't pay into the system doesn't deserve to live within the system. But the same ideas were being championed by popular people in the United States, including Eugene Debs, but also including people who we consider to be much more popular presidents. Franklin D. Roosevelt was one of them. And the fact is that Franklin D. Roosevelt, I personally believe, would have been considered a truly terrible president had it not been for the fact that he led the United States during World War II. And World War II really put into perspective why American freedom is so important, because so many people were being destroyed by Nazi Germany and by the brutality of the Japanese regime as well. And even until the USSR decided to join the Allies because of course, being attacked by the Nazis. But even their brutality as well, when they were part of the Axis, this really put into sharp relief what it meant to be free under the United States rule instead. The idea that the individual was so important that nothing that the government, no government could make a rule that could take away their rights. It became so important and so in relief. But the fact is that Franklin D. Roosevelt was quite the sympathizer for the socialist idea. And he was also a leader who really had a bit of a God complex. He wanted to be that powerful leader who stayed in power. And this is seen, he was the only president who tried to run and did run four times for president. He, of course, said it was to keep stability during World War II. But the simple fact is that while, of course, he was popular, he had his popularity boosted by World War II, he had a bit of a dictator mentality and a bit of a socialist mentality as well. And he was willing to try to change the norms of the United States, the norms of the fact that presidents only ran twice. but also the norm that socialism, the idea that society wasn't as important as the individual, was going to change in the United States. And he and other politicians like Eugene Debs really brought this into the forefront of American life. And I feel it's been a bit of a parasite. I don't even want to say I feel it, because to say I feel it says that it's my opinion, that it's been a bit of a parasite on the American psyche. And the fact is, though, that it has been. It's because of this idea, this socialist sympathy that was in the United States, and not the idea that socialists, all people who say they are socialists, are evil, horrible people. I'm not saying that. So don't get me wrong. There is a difference between someone who has a socialist idea, right? And this is not some type of neo-McCarthyism where we're trying to out everybody who's socialist or communist. No. But rather the idea that society was more important than the individual gained traction in the United States because we had prosperity and because people were trying to get ahead. And they decided, because the United States had money and had riches, but it wasn't coming to me personally, let's try to fix society so that society has to give everybody a fair piece of the pie. You started selling your soul to the devil to get what you wanted. The American people started selling their soul a little bit, in that they decided that it was more important to have entitlements, to have certain government things, rather than to preserve their individual freedom of choice. And now this is becoming a real problem in the fact that there is a massive surveillance state over the United States, that our technology, and this is something I talked about last week, so go back and check it out. I think it's a good companion thing to look at, that our technology is now being used as a way to control our behaviors, and it's not considered something so horrible that we're willing to walk away from products we want. And what's more, there are politicians in the United States. And I don't think it's a party thing. I think it's a people want to be entitled thing. But there are politicians in the United States who think it more important that we have things that we want, like a free healthcare system. Yeah, it's good to have healthcare. I really do believe that if someone came out to my door and they needed help, that it would be my moral obligation to help them, right? That they, if they needed help having a surgery or they would die, of course, I would be glad to pay. I would be glad to help. But the fact is, as soon as we decide that it is up to the government to determine whether or not we deserve it, that each person should be able to have free stuff, of course that stuff isn't free. It's coming from taxes. And we're like, okay, let's just give our money to the government. Fine. But the problem is, as soon as you conglomerate so much power into the government doesn't give it away freely. And we saw that during the 1920s and during the 1940s. And it led eventually to the Cold War, because instead of confronting Russia when we should have, they weren't our friend. They started as part of the Axis. And later on, because they were surprise attacked by the Nazis, they became an ally, or a very reluctant ally, should I say. But we should have taken care of them, because their ideology was so evil that it led to millions of Russians being killed. Also, millions being kicked out of the country, like my family. Because for the simple fact that we were Jewish, and that didn't sit well with the Russians at the time. But the simple fact is, as soon as you give that much power to a country, nothing short of many years of violence, of bloodshed, of mistrust, of Cold War, of real war, will lead to a change. And that's probably been the biggest mistake for freedom in the United States today. This is the Motherlode Show. I'm Jackson Dunn. Check out other episodes. Also last week's, please go check that out if you didn't last week. I mentioned it a couple times, but really it's a great companion. This is a part one and two series, so that would be good. Anchor.fm, Castbox.fm, wherever you get your podcast, or right here on WVCR. Thanks so much for joining me. I'll be back next week with the Motherlode Show.